Hannah Stanley filling in tonight for Matt Bubala. Man, I'm so excited. It is time for my friend Fred Weintraub to join us, calling in from London. Last time we spoke to you, Fred, hi. You were in Singapore.
You know, I keep inching my way towards you in Chicago, and that will happen very quickly. But I'm here in London today, and have been for the last 10 days to see all the drama play out, not only from a Charles Dickens standpoint as it relates to Christmas,
yes,
but from a Brexit standpoint and from a royal standpoint. So it's all good, and I'm glad to be with you.
I'm always thrilled to welcome you on air with me, and I'm excited to hear you on WGN. Let us start with Brexit. One, it was Roger's request to talk about this. Let me start with the fact, though, that here in the States, and you know I was following the story very closely, I thought Theresa May was done. And I kept hearing, well, they think she has enough votes to survive. And I was like, there's no way. Did we here in America get kind of a different perspective on that story than what you guys were expecting? You're an expat, we get that. But over in London, was this less of a big story than maybe it was here?
No, I think that you and Roger are right. It was a huge story, but with a different perspective. So you got to remember that, in my expat life, I've come to learn that people care about what's happening in their particular country, in their particular city. So does anybody in Chicago really care about what's happening with Brexit? You know, if your finances or if your job relates to the economy, maybe the answer is yes. But other than that, it doesn't really affect you. Now, if you live in the UK, it does affect you from an economic standpoint. And Theresa May was worried because this is all about politics, at least at the early stages. And so 48 members of the Tories party decide that they're going to get enough letters, which they did, to call for a no confidence vote, which means that she has an opportunity that means that there's a risk of getting thrown out of office. So she's busy traveling around to Europe and to Germany and to meet with the president of France and the German chancellor to try to get support for Brexit. In the meantime, she's got a crisis at home because the next day, Parliament is going to take this vote to see whether she is going to remain as the prime minister. So I would say during the day, there was a sense that she could be in really big trouble. And if she gets out of this, it'll be very close and it'll be a slim margin. The difference, the way the news was really reported, is that by early evening, so the vote was going to take place in private, and you know, anytime there's a private vote, whether it's an average Chicagoan going into a voting booth, or whether
times.
It's a parliamentarian going into one of the rooms in Parliament to vote, it's a secret ballot. So with human nature being the way human nature is, people say, oh, I'm going to do this or I'm going to do that, and they go into the ballot box, and lots of times they don't exactly do what they say publicly they're going to do. Mm-hmm. So even though by early evening the commentators here on the BBC and politicians who were, you know, spinning the entire story were indicating that she had enough votes to survive, you really don't know. So in the two-hour period of time, from I think 6 to 8 o'clock in the evening, this vote was taking place. Then they announced that the vote will be made public at 9 p.m. Well, at about 8:20, you saw that Theresa May was heading back to her home at 10 Downing Street. So she zooms out of Parliament in her silver jag with security, and she's in Parliament. She's in 10 Downing Street by 20 minutes to 9, which is kind of a good indication that maybe it wasn't too bad of an evening. And 9 o'clock, the vote comes out, and she needed to get half of the Conservative Party plus one in order for her to remain in power. Well, she got 200 of conservative votes. I think 317 is the number that is the number in total. So 117 people said we want to throw, 117 ministers said we want to throw you out, but 200 said that they wanted to keep you, maybe not because they loved Theresa May, but because they thought if we have to start again and erase the scoreboard and erase the plan and go back to zero, we'll be even in worse trouble. So the answer to your question is, by early evening, I think there was a reasonable sense that she was going to survive. But now that she has survived, she's already been back in Brussels, as you know, and it was less than a pleasant conversation with the president of the EU. Because remember, the EU, made up of these 28 countries, is saying, look, you're only one of these countries, and we've been spending a lot of time talking about Brexit, and they're interested in their own particular country. So I think they're kind of sick of the EU. I think they're kind of sick of the UK. And so bottom line is there's still going to be a fight on their hands because they need to come up with a deal by, I think, January 21st. And right now they don't have a plan B. And so she has survived. That's probably good news. She's also said as part of the deal she will stand down for re-election in 2022. Now, maybe that was the deal that she had to cut behind the scenes in order for her to survive another date.
Right. You help me today, and then you guys can have your party can take over, or at least have the option in 2022. I'll walk away.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
Now,
you never know what's going on.
Explain this to me, please, if you would. What would have happened if she had been kicked out? If all of a sudden, no confidence vote, she doesn't have the votes, she's kicked out as prime minister, obviously somebody else would have stepped in. But regarding Brexit, would they have then walked away and started from very, very scratch where they have to put this up for a vote to the British Royal Empire again? Or do they then just start working on a new deal within Brexit because that is what the people voted for?
I think the answer is that they would have the ability to do any of the above. They could throw it all out and they could say, let's go back and put another referendum out there and see if people still want Brexit. Probably the common sense thing is that they would work with what they had, see what made sense. And remember, it's all about negotiations, just like it is at City Hall. Mm-hmm. Where is their compromise? Where can we get this through? It probably doesn't make sense to have started from scratch. Although I will tell you this, and this is just the worldly fellow's opinion on this. I think that if you go back and you put it out for referendum and you say, vote again, it was 52 to 48 last time, do you want this to happen? I think that a lot of people would say, ugh, this was a lousy 2 years. We don't want this to happen. We decided we'll take our mulligan. We'll stay within the EU. But you never know what's going to happen. You never know what's going to happen, and it's politics, so anything can happen, and the drama will continue.
The drama will continue, but it's very interesting because it reminds me a little bit of the Affordable Care Act. Everybody was like, no, this is great, this is what we want, but then they didn't really understand how this was all going to play out. There were so many details that maybe were and maybe weren't already decided. This has become a lot of drama. So again, though, we here in the States can be getting a very different angle on this than you guys are getting over in London.
Yeah, I think the angle, just like with Obamacare, boils down to the following. If you're a politician, so they all get this 550-page report. You never know whether they've read the whole thing, whether they understand the whole thing. You know, the public doesn't understand part of what's, you know, what they understand the parts that they want to go over, that they want to understand. Do they understand the intricacies? No. Maybe if they understood the intricacies, they would have said, this isn't good for us. Let's stay with the, as a member of the EU. Right. Or they could go the other way and they could say, you know what, the economy is not great in the UK. There's a lot of unemployment. For some people, that may be a sense of desperation. And so they'd say, you know what, let's try Brexit. It's the next, you know, it's the next popular drink. Let's get out of the EU. So I don't know. I mean, you don't really know. And you can't really, you know, if you, I wouldn't say you can't trust the politicians. In Theresa May's defense, and this is not Fred Weintraub giving his political view on any of this, she got handed a bag of goods by David Cameron. So all she was trying to do was she was trying to live. Basically, David Cameron said, we're going to put this up for referendum. He put it up for referendum, and we voted to get out of the EU. All she was trying to do was what she thought the people wanted to do, what wanted to have her do, and to do the right thing for the country. Now, whether the country changed their mind midstream, that's another question, which is kind of what I think is happening.
And
so
that's what the
other...
She's got
to be one tired... She's got to, if I feel jet lag most of the time, she's got to be one tired lady because she literally traveled from Europe back to the UK, back to the EU meeting with little sleep, with the prospect of not having a job, and
well, and then she's got to move out.
And it was a rough
week for her. Thing. Yeah. That's, I mean, if she loses her job, she's got to move. That's like, that comes with the position. That it's like being president.
That's a big problem.
She has to find a new flat.
I haven't been invited. I think the gigs at 10 Downey Street are probably pretty cool. Although you could look at it the other way. Most politicians that leave office one way or the other, they do quite well financially. Michelle Obama is coming to the O2 Center on April 21st of next year. So there is great excitement about that. So I don't think you have to have a tag date for Theresa May, but she wants to finish her role, whatever that role is going to be.
People want a good legacy and they want to be remembered fondly. Fred, we are going to continue with you, take a quick break, but you and I have been discussing this for days. We have so much to talk about. Quick break with Fred Weintraub, our worldly fellow. More after this with Hannah Stanley filling in tonight for Matt Bubala. Hannah Stanley.
Let it be.
Paul McCartney. And Fred Weintraub, our worldly fellow, calling in from London. Fred did the coolest thing possible. Fred, you and I have never, ever, ever once discussed the Beatles. Never.
I didn't even know you were a Beatles fan.
Crazy, but not like that's all I listen to and it's my ringtone, but just like I have moments where just asked me what my favorite Beatles song was, and I just like leaned back and smiled because it took me a minute to really just kind of go through that catalog and all the different moments that I've had listening to those songs and learning about the writing on, and Let It Be, I just learned recently. Thank you, Carpool Karaoke, that Mary was actually Paul McCartney's mother's name. So when he says, Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be, he actually had a dream where his deceased mother, Mary, spoke to him and said he was very upset about some things and said, let it be. And that's how that song came to be.
Wow.
I know. I just learned this. So Fred did the coolest thing today. Out of the blue, I get an email from our worldly fellow who's on joining us from London. And he said, look what I did. I made a promo for you. He wrote my name and WGN 720 on the wall at Abbey Road. Seriously.
And that's the, like, the coolest thing.
Coolest
thing ever.
When we were there, Bridget and I forgot to... I was so excited to get a picture of her and I walking across the street.
That you didn't write anything.
I took pictures of what people had written, but I didn't write. It didn't even enter my mind. In fact, you know what the coolest thing was that we did? There's an online camera there.
Oh.
A 24/7 video camera that shows the crosswalk and the building and all that. And so we called our niece, who was a big Beatles fan in Atlanta, and woke her up.
Sure.
And said, "Hi, we're waving at you." And sure enough, she went to the website and saw us waving at her.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah.
No, I've got the picture. It is on my Facebook page and on my Instagram post. You can see the cool thing that Fred did for me earlier. Well, actually, it was yesterday, technically. But thank you very much for that. That was amazing. But you are currently in London. But this ties into a story because Paul McCartney's home was robbed.
It was. So, you know, Paul McCartney has a number of homes. And I guess when you're Paul McCartney, you can have a number of homes.
He has Beatles
money. And one of those homes is in a neighborhood which Roger knows really well called St. John's Wood. If you were at Buckingham Palace and you would take the train, the tube, four stops, about 10 minutes, you'd be in St. John's Wood. So you walk a few blocks towards Abbey Road Studios, and if you're a Paul McCartney fan, you see a street called Cavendish Avenue. Make a left-hand turn on Cavendish, walk a half a block, and his house, which he bought, I think, in 1966, is the only house that discreetly has... No, obviously, it has no name on the door, but his gate is total wood. So if you're a Beatles fan, if you're a McCartney fan, you kind of know that that's his house. Well, on December 7th, there were reports that there was disruption at his house, that they think that there was a break-in, that St. John's Wood is a very quiet, quaint, kind of old money. And so they have four police cars pulling up to his house isn't a great thing. Although I will tell you this, and Palmer, having been in St. John's Wood for a number of years, it's not uncommon to see Paul McCartney in the local bakery buying brownies, taking his daughter to school. I even heard him describing a story on one of the radio stations where one year it was Halloween, and he had this urge that he wanted to do the crosswalk at Abbey Road. But he knew that if Paul McCartney did the crosswalk at Abbey Road, it would create quite a stir, to say the very least.
Mm-hmm.
So he dressed up in some type of Halloween costume, told his wife, "Drop me off at Cavendish, and I'll walk over to Abbey Road. No one's going to know who the heck I am." So he did it. He was in whatever outfit, whatever costume he was in on Halloween. He got it out of his system that he once again crossed over the Abbey Road studios. Because normally, when he goes into the studios, he obviously gets driven in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he comes across as an average kind of guy when he's in the neighborhood. But that is, this average kind of guy is 76 years old, and he's going to play the O2 Center on Sunday. So still going strong, still creating music, and he's got the world that loves him because he's a Beatle, and he's had a great career post Beatle. So
yeah,
he's
just released a new album. Yeah, new.
He did.
Is this like his
25th or 26th album after the Beatles?
Since post-Beatles?
He's still going. I should be going that strong at 76.
Oh, I mean, God bless. He's doing 2-hour, 15-minute performances where, you know, he's playing live the entire time. He's not doing costume changes. There's no drum solo. It's just Paul McCartney. He's amazing.
Yeah, you are so right. And apparently, so I'm reading some rag stuff about McCartney, what he does before the concerts. He likes to sit in his candle-scented dressing room and watch trash television. So he's no different than, you know, how we all relax, whether it's binge watching something else or, you know, Downton Abbey or The Crown or whatever it is that you watch. Paul McCartney apparently does the same thing in order to relax, to get ready to go out and sing. It's kind of cool.
Well, I wouldn't call Downton Abbey trash television, but we are going to talk about Downton Abbey, but we have to get to a break. You know how this goes. Fred Weintraub, our worldly fellow joining us from London, is going to stay with us through the break. Hannah Stanley filling in for Matt Bubala. We are going to get you to the news with Roger Badish. God, there are so many names here. And that is going to be right after this on WGN. Hannah Stanley filling in tonight for Matt Bubala. More with our worldly fellow Fred Weintraub. We are going to talk a couple of different things. Downton Abbey. There's Downton Abbey news for those. And because Fred is in London, we must talk with him about that. I can't tell you how many OMGs, OMGs came out of my mouth and out of my fingertips as I was typing that to other people earlier in the day. We also have big news that a person, a particularly famous person, has stopped doing part of what they're particularly famous for. All of that is going to follow the news when we talk more with Fred Weintraub. But in the meantime, here's Roger Badish with the WGN News. The Crawleys, how I have missed thee. Hannah Stanley filling in tonight for Matt Bubala. I don't know how much Matt Bubala talks about Downton Abbey, but boy, Roger and I have.
Oh, yes. We love Downton Abbey. You more than I.
I don't know. But speaking of things that have been my ringtone, that particular suite has been my ringtone.
Ooh.
John DeCasse from the Steve Cochran Morning Show.
Yeah, right. The musical director. Sure.
He and I.
Oh.
Both Downton Abbey fanatics. Fred Weintraub joining us from London, and I would be remiss if I didn't take the opportunity to ask Fred Weintraub, worldly fellow, if all of England is abuzz with the fact that they have released the release date for Downton Abbey movie, which is going to come out in September.
I would say, I think they're probably excited about it behind closed doors.
But in a very British way.
It's a very British way of saying, you know, their level of excitement. You know, I don't know what their level of excitement is when they're at home sipping tea, but it's probably fairly controlled when they're out among the streets.
Mm.
But what is popular, what they are excited about right now is you see all these marquees going up saying a certain movie is coming out on December 21st, and that movie is Mary Poppins. And if you're going to see Mary Poppins, how cool of a place to see it is in London. Not that it won't be cool to see it anywhere around the world, but it just seems like, boy, Mary Poppins coming back to life around the Christmas season.
And it was filmed in London with a very British Emily Blunt starring as Mary Poppins. Of course, the original Mary Poppins was on a soundstage. So it was not on location. So this is exciting, and this is the continuation of the story, not just a remake of the original one. Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame plays Jack, who was a lamplighter, who was a child during the Dick Van Dyke Bert phase of the original movie, and they kind of take it from there.
Yeah, and as you said, it's pretty cool that, you know, they shot it on location. So I remember 2 years ago, you see the movie trailers that are parked along Pall Mall leading to Buckingham Palace, because one of those stately houses near Buckingham Palace, right before you get to Clarence House, mm-hmm. is where they shot a lot of the movie. So I think that it'll probably do really well in the box office, and it just puts an extra smile on people's faces because they know that it was shot here in the UK.
Well, I tell you what, I'm pulling for it, because that Lin-Manuel Miranda, boy, he needs a win, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, you know, it's kind of rough for him, because, you know, he's got Hamilton that's playing everywhere in the world and is playing here, and you have to stand in line literally for a good 40 minutes before you can get in the door here. Although what I think is kind of fun and interesting. So I saw it in Chicago, mm-hmm. and I saw it here in London. The comparison to me was, I mean, it's all great, but the king, the role of the king,
King
here
George,
seems much more, you know, he brings it to a level of 12 here because because he knows he's got the audience and he's got him from a political standpoint, he's got him from a historic standpoint. And he's going to use every bit of theatrical know-how that he has to make sure that he brings down the house here in London, and he certainly does.
Well, that's the part that all of the British people know for sure. They're like, "That's our guy."
Yeah, you're right. They may be turning to their husband and wife or partner for every other part of Hamilton, saying, "I don't really know that part of the story, but you can bet that they know the king part of the story."
Yeah, you know what's funny is we here in the States are doing the exact same thing. People in America don't necessarily know that part of history either, which is part of the brilliance of it, because kids are learning more about their history because of Hamilton. It is so engaging. But yeah, it's really funny because I'm like, British people think they don't know anything about American history. Neither do we. It's okay.
That's true. But Hannah, here's the most important part of going to theater in the West End, which is different than going to theater in the States. At the intermission, they serve ice cream right in the theater.
No, they do not.
They do. Swear to God, we'd bring you back some if it wouldn't melt on a plane, but that's what they do. There's not a show that goes by where they go to intermission. I mean, you would think maybe they would want to serve tea, but they don't. You can either, when you go in, you can sign on a card that says, at the interval, I would like a glass of champagne, or the ushers come out at intermission and you can have some ice cream. So
that's how they
fill that 20 minutes.
That's downright delightful. That's what that is.
It is.
I'm really hoping that the dollar does well against the pound so I can afford to go. That's what I'm hoping.
Well, it's doing well now.
Yeah, of course, because of Brexit.
Now.
We like uncertainty in the British, in this Brexit system. Speaking of uncertainty, I'm very intrigued with how this future is going to play out for a particular gent from over there. It has been announced that Keith Richards has stopped drinking. One, I think pubs in England and all over must be freaking out because one of their most frequent visitors will no longer be coming by. But why now? Is this a story or is this, again, an American story that we're like, oh, good Lord, what are we going to do? Keith Richards is sober.
No, I think it is a real, I mean, it's definitely a real story. And depending on, you know, on what parts of it you read, he's been trying to cut back for about a year now. But I think, based on what I read anyway, that, you know, he's had 75, not 75 years, but he's had a good long career life of drinking to the point of being drunk on stage when they're playing their music. And he's basically come out and said, I pulled the plug on it. I got fed up with it and I'm done with this. It's time to quit. Other people around him, other bandmates are saying it's making him way more mellow. He's open to new ideas. And so in addition to the fact that it's probably a good, healthy thing for him to have cut down, it might be a really good thing for the Rolling Stones, and it might lead to more cool things on the stages of the world as they keep performing. That being said, it doesn't say, and he doesn't say, that every once in a while he's going to have a glass of wine and maybe a pint. I just think he's not going to have 10 pints, and he's not going to have it when he's going on the...
There's not going to be the Jack Daniels sitting on the amp while they're on stage performing.
That's so what's interesting. You tell me whether this is true, because this is going to be my European perspective, and you give me your American perspective on this. So in the afternoon, when you walk to, let's say you're walking to a business meeting or wherever during lunch, you can find business people and people with days off that are standing outside of pubs having a pint at noon. And then in the evening, the way people socialize here is they literally are standing outside, and sometimes it's six or seven deep of people, and they've got their sport jacket on with their scarf, and they're drinking a pint. And that's how people here, to a certain extent, socialize. So it's not, I don't look at it as being uncommon here. But when I get back to Chicago, I don't feel like, you know, I'm not the guy who's hanging out at Rush Street at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I can't really speak to that. But I don't see people hanging outside of bars the way people hang outside of pubs here. But I could be totally wrong.
Place where I really envision that and have seen that is outside of Wrigley Field. That is a very common thing during the summer. The other thing is people standing outside of the bars would be the smokers. Everybody else is inside.
Right.
One, because it's, you know, viciously cold here. Although 45 in December is lovely. That's delightful. But I think as far as like the beer gardens and things like that, that's really just typically in those baseball neighborhoods. A little bit more in the summer, obviously, they sit around in the beer gardens and hang out. But it's not like that where it's fall weather and they're like, oh, let's just put on a blazer and hang out. No.
Yeah, so I think that's a difference. It just seems like a way of life here. And the only negative part of that way of life that I see here is, so when you go to a soccer/football game in the UK, and let's say you go to Wembley to watch whoever your team is, if you're 18 years old or older, you can go to, you stop first to get your four pints of beer. You take those four pints to your seat. You consume those four pints within the first half of the game. Then you can go back and you can get another four pints. And I'm not, I don't believe that consuming eight pints of beer during a two-hour period of time leads to anything good. That's my only negative related to how the drinking scene appears to me here.
Well, I'm starting to understand why Keith Richards developed such a habit, because that seems to be very socially acceptable. That is quite a bit of alcohol.
Right. If I had eight pints during a game, I'd be asleep before the 5 minute mark of the end of the game. But you see all these people that they consume eight pints. And I'm like, how does one do that?
And it's interesting, too, because it's not in the British stereotype. There are other countries where that would be part of the stereotype or the cultural expectations, we'll say. But definitely not something that I would think of the Brits. Oh, they just get hammered at soccer games. That's not what I would think.
Right. Right. And so it's just different. Just like in Chicago. I mean, the whole world thinks that Chicago is the most dangerous place in the world. And is it any more dangerous, and do they have any more of a gun problem than other parts of the world? Here, what you don't hear about, it's not gun problems that they have there. It's knifing attacks. And to me, a knifing attack is much more severe than a gunshot. But at times, gunshots are just random shots that people aren't shooting at one person.
No, the knife.
When you're knifing somebody, you're going after somebody and you're up close in order to hurt them. And that's a real problem here in the UK.
That's again not something that we have heard about really in depth, at least here in the States. You know, I remember there was a story 2 years ago, maybe, where there was a very public, I think it was with a machete, but that was kind of a one-off story. We don't hear very much about it because everyone here in the States, specifically here in Chicago, of course, gun violence, gun violence, gun violence, with good reason. But
yes,
we don't hear about really what is sort of equitable or the comparison overseas. What we do hear is how overseas they're not having this problem with gun violence. So
right. It's just interesting to see how, you know, all these cultures, all these societies, you know, they've all got their own state of problem. I would tell you 2 weeks ago, as I was walking through a neighborhood in Singapore, I thought to myself, there are no homeless people here. Hmm. But then and part of the cool thing, you know, part of the worldly fellow cool thing for me is to be able to learn about some of these new cultures and live some of these new cultures. And I formed some opinions, some that I think are based in actual fact. Some are based in my own reality, based on my own perspective of what I know in living in Chicago, what I know living in London, what I'm trying to learn in living part-time in Singapore. And so I come to find out that in Singapore, they have this government housing type of deal. And so what I take it as, they sweep this issue under the rug where they put all these people in some kind of government housing, but they're really hiding the homeless population so that the world, the expat world of Fred Weintraub doesn't see that. And so he sees no homelessness. He sees, you know, in Singapore, he obviously sees no chewing gum in Singapore. But well, it's interesting to see how all these different governments handle all this.
Perspective is reality, and that's what they're trying to do. Now, if they're quote unquote hiding them, but they're actually helping them, well, then good for Singapore. If they're hiding them to hide
them.
That's
true.
Eh. All right. Fred, we have got to take a quick break. We have to come back and talk about my completely healthy obsession with the royal children. No one, there's no reason to alarm authorities. It is completely natural that I am this obsessed with the royal children. More with Fred Weintraub, our worldly fellow, as I, Hannah Stanley, fill in for Matt Bubala right after this on WGN. Hannah Stanley here. We are running out of time. Unfortunately, with Fred Weintraub, this always happens. The worldly fellow and I get to chatting. Fred, the Christmas cards came out today. The pictures, the official pictures. You are in London, for those of you just joining us. Fred joins us from London. But the royal family Christmas card photos were released today to the public via social media, as they now do. And they are beyond amazing. It was very interesting to see the difference in photographs, because William and Catherine released a very, very casual country, if you will, outdoor shot with the three kids. Really the first big picture of Louis, who is their third child, who is beautiful. All of their children are gorgeous. And then Harry and Meghan Markle, who I don't think goes by that anymore. But they released a silhouette photo from their wedding, never before seen, fireworks, etc. They're looking, of course, into welcoming a child in the spring. But really, really interesting how each of the family branches released a very different image.
And it's interesting that, you know, that image is very manipulative, and that's what they want you to see. Not that the Cambridges are not trying to create, you know, a really great childhood for their three children, but they want the people of the UK to know, hey, we're regular folks. So we're going to take a picture outside, and Prince George is going to be in jeans, and William is going to be in jeans, and that's the picture that they want you to think about, because they want you to think our families like your family. And in the case of Harry and Meghan, they're still on the high of their royal wedding. And when you're at Frogmore House and you have fireworks going off probably towards the end of the evening, and you can take an elegant silhouette shot of that, that's the image they want to present. You can be assured that next year that image will be with a child. And you see, when you see the Queen give her Christmas message, which mm-hmm. she gives on Christmas Day at 3 o'clock, although it's pre-taped, it's no surprise and it's no coincidence that she has pictures sitting at her desk, probably pictures of George, who will be king one day, probably pictures of the Cambridge family, probably a picture of Prince Charles, but it's all done for a reason.
Strategic.
But the bottom line is that those kids are cute. Those kids are cute, and you can hope that they have some type of normal life for a while before they have to take on their royal responsibilities.
They are precious, 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 and seem to be managed very well, be it via nanny or be it via their own parents. But man, do I really like those kids.
Yeah, I think that not knowing, because no one ever knows this, that other than royal functions, they are managed pretty well by their parents. In fact, yesterday, Kate was seen driving up to Buckingham Palace. So even though she had a security detail behind her, she drove up the Range Rover herself, probably which is kind of cool. I mean, they didn't know because the windows are blacking out whether any of the kids are in the back seat. But I think they try to give them as normal a life as they possibly can.
Well, maybe when I'm over there, I'll bump into her at Target. Fred Weintraub joining us, our worldly fellow from London. I will see you this coming week when you come back to Chicago. So safe travels, Fred. And thanks so much for your time.
I will see you next week.
All right. Sounds good. Hannah Stanley filling in again for Matt Bubala.